Okay, I'll start. So this is the last lecture, and we'll see how far we get. We have a hard cutoff because the Center for the Universe won't wait. Starts at 3 o'clock. So I'm going to talk about the possibilistic formulation of general relativity. So I called this Poja, I guess you pronounce that. There's also the probabilistic formulation, which I call Paja. So probabilistic general relativity with agency. And the reason I chose that is because it's homage to the BlackBerry Pager, which is the original device. And this is what the thing I was aiming for was a probabilistic formulation of GR. But an important sort of step on the way to that, and something that's interesting in its own right, is a possibilistic formulation. When you use the word possibilistic, it's often confusing to people in the theoretical physics community, maybe less so in quantum foundations, but even so. So it's worth thinking about what that means. So generally in quantum theory, you have sort of deterministic, you have deterministic or probabilistic theories. If you have a deterministic theory, then you might say that some stuff that happens here, this stuff that happens, tells you what's going to happen here. So you solve some equations and then you evolve them into here. So stuff here determines what's going to happen here. But a different way of thinking about that would be to say, I could consider stuff here and then stuff here, stuff prime, I suppose. And I could ask whether given sets of stuff and stuff prime are possible or not. And if it's the case that for a given stuff here, out of all the different things you could have happen here, only one of them is possible, then you do have determinism. So this is a way of capturing what you mean by deterministic theory, but it's a bit more general because it could be that more than one thing is possible here for some given stuff here. So in any case, if you're trying to take an operational point of view, then this possibilistic formulation seems more suited.
Is it just a question of interpretation of relationship, or is it actually difference in mathematics between this what you call probabilistic and possibilistic? I mean, I'm asking because there is this difference between propensity and probability, and sometimes it's just considered to be a philosophical difference, and sometimes also is it considered to be a mathematical difference.
I'm not sure how to answer that. When you have probabilities, you have real numbers between 0 and 1. And so that's what we'll have. What we have in this case, I won't have time to cover the probabilistic case. Whereas here, we have the number 0 indicating impossible, and the number 1 indicating possible. And then you can put whatever philosophy you want on that. But this is just okay. So we have. I want to define. So remind you, we have this kind of setting where we have operational space. We have sort of regions in operational space, indicated by some letter A. Now, an operation is going to be something like this. We have indices on this symbol A, indicating the different typing surfaces, so A, B, and C, that I talked about a few lectures ago. So these could correspond to surfaces on the surface of this region A. And in the paper, I'm using a different font for this symbol than this one. But here on the blackboard, it's sufficient. You don't need to worry about that because they have these ones have indices on. So this is an operation. So an operation has various pieces of structure. It has a setting associated with it, So this is, I talked about this at the last lecture. It has a set of gammas. So in here, we have different possible gamma A's. And here we have a set of possible gamma A's. If this is a single member set, then you just have one gamma A, but it may have more than one member, in which case you have some kind of coarse grain. Okay. Then we have the region of operational space that we're considering. So that's this region here. And then the last thing we have is the typing surface. And the way the notation is set up is if the direction associated with this surface is pointing away from the enclosed volume, then we write it as a superscript. And if it's pointing towards the enclosed volume, we write it as a subscript. The reason for doing that is when you join two operations together, you'll be matching subscripts with superscripts, and so the direction will be aligned. So this here is the typing surface. Are there any questions here? I realize it may be difficult to follow all of this if you didn't go to the previous lectures, but any questions?
So A, B, and C are each the typing surface?
That's right, yeah. So you can imagine that this here has got, you're denoting various surfaces or collections of surfaces by these letters.
And you're saying that like BC is like the union of B and C with like...
Yeah, so you, it would be the...
joining the...
So B, BC sort of denotes... I think it's hard to represent the fonts, but it would represent the set consisting of this and this.
Is there any possibility conditions on the different silent surfaces?
Where they meet. So there are interesting questions there, which I won't have time to get into. So certainly when you look at the boundary conditions that live on these typing surfaces, then where they meet, they have to be compatible. However, the way we get to those things is that they're induced by solutions, and so they are naturally compatible. But there are some subtleties that I would have time to discuss. So this is sort of similar to an operation in quantum theory. You have a setting, you have a set of outcomes associated with it. You have some particular location in the graph, and then you have the inputs and outputs. So this is the same kind of idea, just...
What are the gamma A's?
The gamma A. Oh, right, sorry, yeah, this... Yeah, I'm not sure if you're at previous lectures, but a solution will induce a surface gamma A. The solution to the general relativistic field equations will induce a certain surface in this operational space. These are scalars, and that gives you this gamma A. So this corresponds to the outcomes. In the analogy in quantum information or quantum theory, you have a box and it has different lights that can flash. And there's a sort of the fine-grained lights that can flash. But you may associate a coarse graining, so you have a set. And so maybe you can have a red, green, yellow, or purple light that can flash. But then you might coarse grain just to the red and green. So that would be your set.
So
in
addition with this, it's like one operation, there's like basically inputs and outputs. So
yeah.
I would understand like the notation, like, one index up, one index down, like this is getting inputs and outputs.
Yeah, so these don't have a time direction significance.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a superscript or subscript is entirely conventional. And you can have the same physics where you just change the so each of these typing surfaces has a direction associated with it. It's conventional, you could change the direction, and then you change the...
So, either inputs or outputs, but basically one is consistent in application of those.
Yeah, so when you join them together, you want to make it so these typing surfaces align. I'll do that shortly.
One more question. If I'm thinking about having a box that has lights that flash,
yeah.
That's some kind of measurement, then I would expect the lights flashing to correspond to a point in my operation space, not a surface.
Not really, because there's operations associated with volumes in operation space, and so what can happen in that volume is a surface.
But you only get that surface once you start moving the box around and doing the same measurement all over your manifold.
If you just think about what can one say about what's operationally happening inside this box, then what you can say is there's this surface or a different surface.
But
so,
to actually make that measurement, you would have to go around your whole space-time having your lights flashing, no? No.
If it's a solution of equations, then yes. Because it's a whole space-time.
No, trying to think of something more prosaic. Imagine you're interested in the weather, and you're interested in the pressure, and maybe you're interested in the pressure readings in some volume of space, okay, at a given time. So that would give you an extended object over that region of space, not just a point. Now, of course, you could consider smaller and smaller volumes, and you get smaller and smaller extended objects, but if you want to know what the pressure reading is for that region of space, you need to give an extended object.
Yes, you could go around measuring the pressure in the whole.
Yeah, but you can imagine.
But every measurement device is finite, so principle.
In some sense, the question is: what are the things that correspond to your measurement outcomes? And you could say, well, the things that correspond to the measurement outcomes are the some point at which you have to say, well, this is the stuff that is my measurement outcome. Okay, because otherwise you just keep going until you get into your neurons in your brain. It's difficult to do physics if you only accept that neurons in your brain correspond to outcomes. So at some point you put them in the physics itself. And the assertion is that the thing that corresponds to measurement outcomes in the physics itself are these gamma surfaces. So it's not as if you go around measuring them, they are the outcomes. There's not a device that measures them, they are the device.
I see.
Okay. Oh, and you can represent these operations diagrammatically. So, an operation like that, you can represent it like this. So, subscripts correspond to arrows pointing in, okay. And superscripts correspond to arrows pointing out. So this operation, one corresponding to that, has these arrows pointing in and out of it. And the good thing about this is it's easier to see what's happening. And then when you join these operations together, you can draw diagrams. So. So we could have something like this. So this would correspond to two regions of operational space which touch at typing surfaces A and C. And then this is the operation you get. You can write it down in this symbolic notation. And then you can now say what it corresponds to in terms of each of the elements. So the agency, the settings, the agent settings, or the agent strategies, I called them, they're given by specifying a choice at each point in operational space. So you just take the union of those choices to get the strategy that's associated with the composite operation. You have to take this, what I'll call this double cup conjunction of the O set, of the outcome set. I'll define that in just a moment. Take the union of the regions, and then typing surfaces are the ones that are left over at the end. So this thing here is the, so that should be a set. The set that you get for the composite region is just the it's just the union of all the sets associated with the region set.
I didn't
think,
but I think the F outgoing error should be like...
Oh yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, this was the same.
Yep. I have a more serious question as well. Do you have the same, are you interested in the same, if there are two operations which don't share a typing surface and they have no connected arrows, no shared indices, do you still have this as a definition? So you can still join?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so you can do exactly everything that's done here. Uh-huh. And yeah, so this will work. This will work. This will work, you just get two disconnected.
Yeah.
And this, you'll have all the same types that you had previously, because there's no contraction of any types. Yeah.
So, does it mean that here we presume specific dimensionality of those settings in the sense that, like, we form a theoretical sum?
Which settings? Sorry.
Like Q, let's say QA and QB, yes?
Yeah.
It's when this sum is formed here by like.
So I define these. So these are, it's sort of a long story how to get to this.
Okay.
I don't have time to go through it again. But it's in each of these regions of operational space, you give a strategy is given by specifying some strategy for each point. So you kind of get a set of choices inside each region, and this is just union. So it's the natural way of combining.
Yeah, my question is only like whether there is like presumed dimensionality that is imposed on Qs and Os, like on Qs and gammas. So like, for example, that those space of like parameters S1, S2, S3,
oh, right.
So
yeah.
Is it like that we are like, for example, fixing dimension n? And we presume that, like, maybe there are zeros, but in principle, it's like a n-dimensional space that is under consideration.
Yeah, maybe we should talk about this later because it relates to the previous. Okay. So now you've got this, and of course we can join together multiple operations. Okay, and we just have, you know, several operations all joined together. And what you're asking when you join together a bunch of operations is you're asking basically a question. You're describing a possible situation, or a situation that you want to consider, where in each of these separate regions you have some gamma set, and you're just describing a situation. And the question you want to answer is whether that situation is possible or not. So, we have something like this, and in each of these operations we have a gamma, and so that describes some operational situation. We want to know if it's possible or not. So we need a calculus to tell me whether these things are possible. So that's what I'm going to try and tell you about in the remaining half an hour. So the way this is going to work is there's going to be a bunch of objects. We start off with operations. We can turn operations into encapsulated propositions, then those into what I call boundary propositions, and then finally we get these things I call generalized states. So there's a bunch of steps. So the first thing is an encapsulated proposition. Okay, so here's a different font. LaTeX provides for multiple calligraphic fonts. And this is a different calligraphic font from the one I used to do the manifolds. It's completely clear if you look at the actual font itself, but on the blackboard it's difficult to represent. So the proposition. So an encapsulated proposition is given by a proposition proposition comes from asserting that the situation is described by some solution that I talked about in previous lectures, and this may be a mixed solution. If it's a mixed solution, then the proposition that we're asserting here is that the actual situation is described by one of the objects which are in the sort of this mixed solution. And we have a strategy, an agent strategy, basically the choice, the knob setting. We have the region, and we also have the typing. So that's the encapsulated proposition. It's possible to go from an operation, like the one up there, to the encapsulated proposition just by writing down the solution that's consistent with that proposition. Okay, so then here you would write. This. That's just the union of the solutions that give you certain gamma sets, or the gammas inside the outcome set. Oh, you have some dim memory of this. Okay. So that tells you how to go from an operation to an encapsulated proposition. The reason I call it encapsulated is because you've got the proposition, but there's also some additional structure. Um, then you can join them. So, so calligraphic A, B. And if you join them like that, then you get a new encapsulated proposition. Which is given by the proposition where you join the solutions using this double cup join I talked about earlier. Which is over the wires where they meet. And then the rest of the structure is the same as in the operational, in the case of operations. This is a way to join operations. So we're kind of getting some physics entering here. We've got physics entering in two places. First of all, we're only considering the things that are actual solutions to the field equations inside each of these regions. And then when we join using this, we have physics in the way we do the boundary conditions. So physics is entering in two different places. So it's possible that if these things don't match, what you get here is just the null, right, just the null solution, which would correspond to the null proposition.
So those boundary conditions there are entering like already there in the equation, oh yes, or just here like
when? Yeah. So there's a big story about when you join together these solutions that correspond to different regions of operational space, how you check the boundary conditions, and there's quite a lot of detail in that as to how to do it. I'd have to tell you about it. So, but this operation here is checking that the boundary conditions match. Okay. Any questions?
So there is operation, and we can get the encapsulated proposition from there.
Yeah.
And then they both have joining operations.
Yeah.
Are those two things compatible? Can I join two operations and then get a proposition?
Right. Or if I this is a good question. And there's some subtleties here that you don't have time to go into. But the answer is that so far as the business of calculating whether something is possible or not is concerned, they are compatible. The subtleties have to do with, behind these things live these manifolds that get joined together, and then on those manifolds live solutions with all this diffeomorphism of each solution. And so there are subtleties about, for example, the manifolds themselves belong to a subset of a chartable space, but the chartable space could be different depending on how you go about forming these objects. And then there's also some subtleties to do with the boundary conditions. However, if you're interested in the possibilistic questions, then yes, these things are equivalent so far as possibilistic questions are concerned. It's a good question. Okay. So when we join these things together, in order to know whether or not we have compatibility, it's really sufficient to look at what's happening at the boundary. If we're only interested in the question of whether something is possible or not, then all the action is at the boundary and not inside the board. And so it's sufficient to restrict ourselves to propositions that live at the boundary. So I call them boundary propositions. And that'll be the next object. So some notation. Okay, that's a new font. So this is a possible boundary condition. So I say it's a pure boundary condition, so it means it's one that can be induced by a pure solution. So the proposition that the boundary condition at typing surface A is this one is written like this. And also it's useful to have the same thing in subscript notation as well. This means the same thing. This is the same proposition, but it's useful to have the case where the index is lowered instead of raised. Now we can write down things like this. It's increasingly difficult to distinguish the fonts. To go from A to B to C, but this is the sans serif font on the subscripts and superscripts. So this is the logical proposition formed by taking the AND of this proposition at typing surface A, and this one at typing surface this one at typing surface B, and this one at typing surface C. Okay. So there's the AND symbols hiding inside there. It doesn't matter which order you write these symbols down in, it corresponds to the same proposition. So if we have an encapsulated proposition corresponding to some solution psi A, so the proposition associated with psi A, then we can write down a boundary proposition. And this is just going to collect the boundary information from psi A. Which is the logical OR of a whole bunch of stuff. And I'll tell you what the stuff is. Okay. This is not, this may take a bit of digesting, but I'll there. So this solution here may be pure, it may be mixed. Let's assume it's mixed for the sake of argument. You can look at the boundary conditions that live on the surface, on these typing surfaces, that are induced by this solution. Okay. And that will give you some boundary conditions. Now, the boundary conditions is something that you can sort into a list just for the pure cases, okay, just like you can sort a solution into the pure cases. And then we're interested in the in boundary conditions here, A, B, and C, which live in the sort of the boundary conditions induced by this. Okay. So. You have a solution, it induces some boundary conditions at the surface, at the typing surfaces. These boundary conditions may be mixed, but you can sort them so you get pure boundary conditions. Now we take the logical OR over the proposition corresponding to those.
Is this delta a choice of specific among various possible boundary conditions?
Is what, sorry?
Is it this theta ABC?
This returns the boundary conditions corresponding to a certain solution.
Also, like it's kind of the original boundary conditions that are used to derive this particular solution. Yes.
No. The solutions aren't derived from boundary conditions. The solutions will induce boundary conditions.
Okay.
And these are the solutions that are these are the boundary conditions that are induced by a given solution. Okay, so when I wrote these notes, I was aware that I wouldn't have time to go from here through the full picture where I talk about doer tenses and so on. So I'm just going to skip over those details and show you what happens next. So this boundary proposition, in a certain well-defined sense, is equivalent to an object like this. So here's, this thing is a generalized state. Here we're using summation convention. So what we have here is a tensor. It's got a bit more structure than a tensor, so I call it a doer tensor, because you can have postscripts and prescripts. But for the purposes of the next few minutes, that doesn't matter. And then here you have a sum over all the possible boundary conditions that live here. And this thing is equal to 1 only in the cases where the A, B, and C are in the sort. Yeah. So this, and it's equal to 0 otherwise. So this is basically picking out all the boundary conditions that are relevant, all the boundary conditions that have support for the solution that you have. OK. And I say this is equivalent to that. We're going to use a certain, what I call possibilistic summation. Etc. So possibilistic summation has the convention that 0 plus 0 is equal to 0, 0 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 is equal to 1. So if you have a 1, get 1. If you have any zeros, you get 0. This is sort of similar to the logical situation that you have a bunch of mutually exclusive possibilities and you're interested in whether something is possible, then as long as one of them is possible, the thing is possible. As long as you have one that's indicated by a one, then you have a possible situation. If nothing is possible, then you have an impossible situation. So this equivalence is modeling this logical behavior in a summation. And you can see this thing here, I call this the generalized state. That's this object here. Contains all the salient information, i.e. the boundary conditions which are non-zero, the boundary conditions which are actually induced by the solution correspond to the non-zero values of this. So this contains all the information you need in order to determine whether some general situation when you join them together is possible or impossible. Are there any questions? Okay. So we have a map. Start off with an operation. That takes us to an encapsulated proposition. Then we're only interested in the information that appears at the boundary. That takes us to a boundary proposition. And then we have, actually this is a two-way map, a generalized state, which just picks out, gives you a zero if the boundary condition is not induced and a one if it is. So if we start off with some operationally described situation like this, what we're describing here is having a certain gamma set living on each of these, and so on, plus also certain choices, and so on. And the question we want to answer is whether the situation that's described by this is possible or impossible. So what we do is we can go through this series of steps, convert them into encapsulated propositions, so convert each of these into encapsulated propositions, and so on. And finally, we get to these generalized states. And now we have a calculation in terms of generalized states. And then we do this calculation, and we get 0 or 1. If we get 0, the situation is impossible. If we get 1, then it's possible. So that's how we formulate general relativity in an operational way. in a possibilistic fashion. Are there any questions on this? So, like I said, you can also set up a probabilistic version of this, and then what you have to do is imagine that there are some ignorance probabilities associated with these elements. So there's some additional probabilistic information hiding behind the scenes. I mean, it's not so trivial to work out how to do that. I introduce what I call loading, just like dice can be loaded. Likewise here, you can think that there's something in the background that corresponds to the probabilistic information. And then these generalized states, rather than having just zeros or ones, they have real numbers. And they give you, at the end, the final calculation gives you a probability instead of just a zero or one. And then the final step, of course, would be to take this to the quantum case. And so far, I don't have a theory of quantum gravity. But this approach suggests a certain strategy. And that is to compare this with classical probability theory, when you have the probabilistic version, and then look at how to convert that into quantum theory, and see if you can use the same technique to convert classical probabilistic theory into quantum theory here, as you do normally. There are subtleties involved. The biggest issue, I think, is the causality issue. In standard quantum theory, you have a well-defined causal structure in the background, so you get this beautiful Pavia causality condition. That tells you what operations are allowed and what are not. Whereas here, because you don't have that fixed causal structure in the background, it's not so clear what causality condition is. Like I said last time, the goal really is to imagine, if you think of a situation in special relativity is that you have the metric in certain inertial coordinates can be written down as the Minkowski metric everywhere in special relativity, whereas in general relativity you need field equations. And over here, in the case of quantum theory, this is classical. In the case of quantum theory, you have the Pavia condition, the Pavia causality condition, which tells you how the quantum objects are circumscribed, what's the space of allowed generalized states. I mean, over here, we want the sort of generalization. So if we can find a sort of generalization of the Pavia condition to a case where you have non-fixed, where you don't have a fixed causal structure in the background, then this might be the right thing, the thing which is analogous to the Einstein field equations in this sort of operational framework. Well, that's the last lecture in the course. Thanks. I think I tried to use the word Pavia as often as I could to embarrass Paula. Any question before we all continue? Yeah.
So I don't think I understood the boundary proposition properly, but the encapsulated proposition is based on this whole lecture for probably based on like learning the matching condition.
Yeah, yeah.
So in some sense, we're doing all this matching, and then just to say true or false.
Yes. That's the final goal is to say true or false. Yeah, yeah.
Is there a neater way to do that without having to go through? I mean, given that we went through all that, we might as well calculate the probabilities for that. So.
But there were no probabilities anywhere. You need to put probabilities in somewhere, which you can do, but that's the part of the paper I didn't talk about. But it is true that we do a tremendous amount of work to understand how to get these boundary conditions, how to understand the solutions, and then in the end we're just interested in looking at boundary conditions to get a 0 or a 1. But that was the goal. The possibilistic formulation, at least, is to determine whether something is possible or not. And I think this is what you can hope for in an operational formulation of generalizability. Because it's just a deterministic theory. So in the end, all you can determine is whether something is possible or impossible. Any more?
I think this project was covered, so I may ask you later, but it was somehow not understood by me in what sense solutions produce boundary conditions and not the opposite. I understand it probably is like a question of terminology, but
it's
to the opposite direction.
Yeah, I did start to wonder if I'd used the wrong name. Rather than calling them boundary conditions, I should have called them compatibility conditions. Because the real point of those is to get a sufficient set of conditions that you can check compatibility, where these solutions meet on boundaries, and if the compatibility conditions are met, then you have a solution for the global, for the total region.
So in principle, it's actually like sort of like localized integrability conditions. Like,
yeah, maybe that.
Basically, the question is like whether two solutions are part of the larger integral.
That's right. Yeah.
So like it's actually like
sort of
an extension of the state. Like,
Yes, basically, just do they meet? And because it's a separate question as to whether you can determine the solution from its boundary conditions, or the things I've called boundary conditions.
So this is basically compatibility.
Yeah. Maybe I might even change that terminology in the paper before I.
Now it makes sense.
Okay, great. Thank you.